Welcome to Keith Tonight, Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Today, I'm joined by Jim Bovard to discuss his new book, Last Rights, The Death of American Liberty. Mr. Bovard, where is the best place for people to find this book and purchase it?
Amazon is the best place right now. It might be in bookstores later in the coming months, but for right now, Amazon's a good bet. Some other websites are running it. I think Barnes & Noble, Books a Million, places like that. Amazon, offers free shipping if you're Prime. So I don't know. That's where I get them.
Sounds good. Links to it will be in the description below. The Death of American Liberty. What would you say liberty is if you really had to narrow it down?
The absence of government coercion. There's going to be a lot of coercion in your daily life from if you choose to, take contracts or live with people who beat you or stuff like that. That's a violation of your liberty and your rights. But what I focus on is the threats to freedom from government, because it's a lot easier to get a handle on that.
In your book, you say federal law enforcement agencies arbitrarily confiscate more property from Americans each year than all the burglars steal nationwide. What evidence do you have for this, and what are you referring to?
Hey, I saw it in the Washington Post. It has to be true. there are studies that look at the total amount of confiscations by federal agencies under the asset forfeiture program, which is confiscation. Civil asset forfeiture means that they're seizing property even though there's been no criminal conviction. That the cops make an accusation, and that's all they need to seize your property. And the other side of that equation is the estimated losses from burglars. I think that's compiled by maybe the Bureau of Justice Statistics or some other sources.
I love this because you say, look, government is not the only criminal to look out for, but it's certainly the biggest one. So you compare and contrast private burglaries versus state confiscation. You said the IRS pilfered more cash from private banks accounts because of alleged paperwork errors than the total looted by bank robbers nationwide. What is it that the IRS is doing to where they can get people's money like this just out of paperwork errors?
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that makes me cynical. So there's an IRS regulation that says if someone withdraws slightly less than $10,000 or deposits slightly more than or slightly less than $10,000 in cash to their bank account, that's considered to be structuring. And the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970, which made it a federal crime for banks to keep secrets from the government. But one of the provisions in there is that it prohibits structuring the deposits and withdrawals in a way to evade federal reporting requirements for bank accounts. And so what the FBI, what the IRS did is go in and see, simply look at bank accounts for businesses mostly, and saw that there were a lot of service type businesses that had a lot of deposits either right around that $10,000 reporting benchmark, but just under. So the IRS just kind of came in and seized their money with no evidence. It was a huge scandal. There were a number of investigations, and the IRS was eventually forced to back down.
You also mentioned federal this one just drives me up the wall because it makes me so sad to see all the homelessness in America. You say federal bureaucrats blocked landowners from farming or building on 100 million acres of their own property because of puddles, ditches, or other suspected wet spots. What is this in reference to?
This is in reference to federal wetlands policy. The Clean Water Act in the early 1970s said claimed jurisdiction to prevent pollution of the nation's waterways. What the EPA and other federal agencies have done is claim that that also includes wetlands, because that's kind of like the waterways, even though there's no ships on them. But it's pretty clear what is a river or and even what is a creek. it's not so clear what a wetland is. And so you had the feds coming in and saying that land that was dry for 320 days per year was a wetland because for certain weeks it had a lot of rain and then there were some puddles. And so you had the feds coming in, and this is a huge issue for farmers because there'd be areas on a farmer's turf that might have some ditches or gullies or stuff like that where the water would collect. And you got the federal inspectors coming in saying, well, this is wetlands, so you're prohibited from farming in this entire area. And there have been so many Supreme Court cases back and forth on this. There was a case that decided in May or June, the Sackett's case out of Idaho. And this is a couple that had bought a plot of land for their retirement home back in 2007. They started to build. EPA came in and threatened, I think, $50,000 a day fine if they kept building. So they stopped. They went to the Supreme Court. They won in 2012. And then they thought their nightmare was over. Nope, no such luck. Feds came in again, and so they had to keep suing. Thanks to the Pacific Legal Foundation, helped them out and made it possible. But the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 that the feds had mistreated these homeowners, and so these landowners, and they are able to proceed now. But there are so many other people, other cases like this around the nation, people whose lives have been turned upside down because of these arbitrary wetlands policy. One of my favorite examples on this is something called the glancing geese test. Now, this is something which federal bureaucrats pulled out of their fill in the blank back in late 80s, early 90s. And so the feds would claim jurisdiction over private land if there were migrating geese who flew over and glanced down at a water hole there or a puddle and thought about stopping, but didn't stop. So the only thing that was necessary for the government to claim jurisdiction was to have a geese glance at the land.
There is an amazing dichotomy that Tom Hartman, the popular progressive, points out to us. He says, look, either we could have a government where people are voting or things are just run by billionaires. What do you think about that dichotomy? Either everyone is running things and really chipping in and having a say, and then there's the alternative to that, which is only billionaires calling the shots.
Well, I think of Zuckerberg buying the 2020 presidential election with all of his handouts to the big city offices to go out and sign up ballot harvesting and stuff like that. It's an unfortunate dichotomy. I guess being old fashioned, what I'd like to see is a government under the law, no matter who is supposedly running it, government under the Constitution, government compelled to respect citizens' rights. But, that's pretty damn archaic at this point.
When you think of examples where liberty really flourishes, do certain times in American history come to mind? Is it other countries? Is it the degree to which people have freedoms in certain countries? What are your empirical examples of liberty working for the masses or being very beneficial?
Oh, good. Excellent question. I think if you look at early American history, especially before the Civil War, you had a much lighter government with a huge exception of slavery, which was a great blemish on the country. And you had groups, women in many areas or in cases were not, did not have the full right to own property or contract. But aside from those two huge caveats, you had vastly more freedom. You had more prosperity. You had people building up lives of their own. And for the 1840s and 1850s, you had a relatively low tariff barriers. So the U.S. was a lot more connected to the world markets than it had been before or afterwards. And certainly until it was, until long after World War II. So
when it comes to how you differentiate any discussion with, say you're talking to a well-intended conservative, what is it that you'd say to them as to why they should take their worldview and extend it, to have this principle of, they're usually Christian, they say, thou shalt not murder, but they give the government this total blank check to murder. I mean, God commands thou shalt not steal. and they advocate mass theft. But if any other group did what the government did, they'd obviously see it as theft. So when it comes to your message to conservatives, what do you tell them as to why they should reconsider their position?
Good question. I talk about things like asset forfeiture, because most conservatives do not have a most conservatives are like most people, that they don't have a lucid recognition of how the government is violating individual rights. And the asset forfeiture is a wonderful example, because like I was writing in the book there about the DEA, the DEA and the TSA team up at airports. And if someone is transporting more than $5,000 in cash, then the DEA and the TSA decide, well, you know, this is probably drug money, so we're going to seize it. There's a formality. Sometimes what they do is bring in a narcotics dog who sniffs at the money and then says, oh, yeah, that proves it. So the gun's a drug dealer, even though the vast majority of currency has micro traces of cocaine that would, or other drugs that would trigger a canine alert. And besides that, the dogs aren't trustworthy. But so the asset forfeiture is one example. The gun control is another example. There was a case here in Maryland, within 10 miles of where I live, 6 miles of the local SWAT team killing a young libertarian-leaning gun owner in a pre-dawn raid for no good reason. I wrote about that a lot. I wrote about it in this book. But people didn't want to hear about it. But it's something which, if you're, there are reasons why folks should favor transparent government and government officials on a leash. We don't have either at this point.
And how does that differentiate from your message to progressives or Democrats when you're trying to explain the importance of freedom to them?
Drugs. No, there's... I mean, there are a lot of examples. Again, the asset forfeiture stuff is great, because you had the government coming in there and saying, okay, if there was simply making an accusation of drug use or any tie-in, then that nullifies the individual's right to own property. There was, I think, a DEA agent who said that the asset forfeiture law is great because you... because it's not necessary for us to prove that the property is guilty. The owner has to prove it's been innocent. And if you're talking about a $100 bill, it's hard to know where it might have been 10 years ago. But there's the asset forfeiture stuff is fun, because there was a case I discussed in there, the Bennis case out of Michigan. There was Detroit had a law that said that if somebody was... had picked up a prostitute and they were parked along the city street and they were engaged in commerce, the city could seize the car. And so you had the Detroit police seizing thousands of cars a year under that law. Then there was a test case that came along, because there was a steel worker who picked up a hooker on the way home and parked. And it turns out the car was co-owned by his wife. And, you know, so the innocent owner case came in there in perfect, lucidity, because she did not approve of her husband picking up the prostitute. The Clinton administration Justice Department said, well, you know, she should have done more to make sure her husband didn't abuse the car. I mean, this was not the standard that they used when they were investigating Bill Clinton. But there are a lot of funny wrinkles in that case. The Chief Justice upheld the seizure based on some cases precedents set on piracy in the 1820s, even though he didn't explain the parallel between piracy then and oral sex in the nowadays. And my favorite part of one of the dissents was that the Justice John Paul Stevens said that, you know, there are a lot of bad implications to this decision. And for instance, with the way the law was written, if the Bennis, the steel worker, had picked up the prostitute and kept on driving while she earned her fee, the car could not have been confiscated. And see, that's the way the Supreme Court decision encourages really reckless behavior.
There is one of these stories that I can't read too many of them because they just drive me nuts. But here is a Reason Magazine. After Minnesota retiree Geraldine Taylor fell $2,300 behind on her property taxes, Hennepin County seized her condo, sold it, and kept every penny to satisfy her debt. A case that the U.S. Supreme Court is considering asks whether this particular strain of government theft is constitutional. In 2010, Taylor, then in her early 80s and now at 94, moved out of her Minneapolis condo, which she owned, and relocated to an apartment in a safer neighborhood. Long story short, they just steal the woman's house. So, in response to this, you will often get something like, well, one, she broke the law that she knew exists. Second, if you have nothing to hide, basically don't be hiding anything. Just be transparent. And she ended up having to give up the condo and give the money to the state. So all is well because the law is being followed. What do you think about this more or less might makes right idea that people will often use? If you have nothing to hide, hide nothing, just follow the law and you'll be fine.
Well, it's almost like people pretend that the law is just, and some laws are. But there was a huge scandal here in nearby where I live, District of Columbia, Washington, D.C. They were doing these kind of similar things. They were doing tax auctions. The private entities would purchase the right to foreclose on the people who had fallen behind on their tax bills. And there was just horrendous abuse, insider abuse, failure of notice, all kinds of things. And the victims were lower income folks, mostly, especially in the lower income, higher crime areas in D.C. So it kind of got swept under the rug for a long time. These are folks who could not afford a K Street lawyer to kick the government down the street if they try to do that crap, like people that would live in the Palisades area of D.C. So there's just all, once you say that the government is entitled to disregard fair play, you're going to have a lot of atrocities. There was one of my favorite examples in the book was what happened. The 2008 Farm Bill had a provision that was just, it was a 700, 800 page bill, something like that. And there was one little paragraph that said, that the statute of limitation would no longer apply to the collection of debts to the federal government. So what that did is unleash the IRS effectively to seize tax refunds from people who the IRS or Social Security Administration claim had been overpaid or their parents had been overpaid decades before. So you had cases of people whose parents might have died young. And the IRS and the Social Security Administration, IRS, came in with no evidence and said, well, 30 years ago, the Social Security overpaid your mother $2,000. So we're seizing your tax refund. And it was just a onslaught of horrendous abuses. The Washington Post did some excellent pieces on this. And it, the feds basically backed off on that. But, it's so obvious you're going to have horrendous due process abuses when you have that kind of law. But hey, it worked out good for federal revenue.
When it comes to propaganda techniques that people should be aware of, I'm curious what you think are the great propaganda techniques that people need to watch out for. The one that comes to mind while you're thinking of that is the concept of no costs. Or they will say something like, well, we're going to bring democracy to Libya. We're going to keep people safe by having a federal bureau of investigation. It's federal, so it's for everyone. A bureau, nice building, an investigation. What's wrong with investigating? You're just looking into things. So all these times we're going to stop Putin from taking over Eastern Europe. Well, they're just stopping him. There's no downside. There's no collateral damage. So that is the one that I always come across where they say there's only benefits. We should have universal free health care, which is as dumb as saying, the military's free because the government pays for it. So this concept of them always saying that there's only benefits and no costs is what I think is the biggest propaganda technique. What are some of the ones you come across that people should watch out for?
Well, that's a good example of a propaganda technique, and it works well for people that failed mathematics. Because if there's always, anytime you have the government forcibly intervening, there's going to be costs. And simply because the government can sweep the costs under the rug, or the government, the pro-government media is going to ignore it, it doesn't mean the costs don't exist. There were all kinds of appeals, especially after 9/11. You know, you're either with us or against us. You know, back when George W. Bush promised to rid the world of evil, I knew America was screwed. Because you know, you're basically unleashing total power, and you have the, you know, with the way that the Bush's appointees you know, seize that power, as far as torture, as far as total surveillance, as far as launching wars on false premises, I don't know why anybody would have expected a happy ending.
Yeah, definitely seems like when you give people this blank check, they almost inevitably abuse it. And I think of, well, you know, if I were in their situation, I might do the same exact thing. I would be so tempted to take advantage. I mean, it's just so, you know, self-serving to say, you know, if I were given a blank check, I'd put a small amount on the check. It's like, well, these people are such status and they love voting for it, so maybe I'm going to take advantage of it. So the whole thing is not necessarily, well, we need to elect different Democrats or Republicans, but instead privatize everything to where people actually bear the cost of the downsides of how they act. When it comes to privatizing things, I think of the importance of schooling along with private security. When it comes to solutions, do you see the private sector filling in any of the voids created by the state as far as people needing a genuine service like education or protection of their property?
Yeah, I've got a chapter in the book called Schools Gone Wild. And it was fun to walk through some of the crazy stuff the feds have done with No Child Left Behind, for instance, which basically encouraged states to lower their education standards in order to claim that they were making adequate progress and therefore keep getting their federal grants. Then you had the Obama administration come in and actually set up specific racial goals for different races, blacks, Hispanics, whites. And in state after state, the Obama administration certified lower goals for black students and for white students. Now, if George Wallace had done this down in Alabama, people would have been outraged. And there were some NAACP groups and some black parents that were outraged by this, but it got swept under the rug. Then you've got the Obama folks dragged in Common Core, which dragged down reading and math. It's made a complete mess out of the math teaching. And then you had the teacher unions helping shut down the schools during the COVID lockdowns, and this horrendous impact on minority and low-income students. Much worse than other students, because the minority and low-income students were less likely to have good internet access, or, you know, parents to say, "Hey, pay attention, do your work," stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, and almost anything is going to be better than that. I mean, I think back to my own time in high school; it was one of the most brain-dead times of my life. Some people might think that the current book is an exception to that, but. And it was just, you know, getting out of the mandatory schooling environment was just, it was like mentally liberating. And I've heard the same from a lot of kids who were in government schools and then started to be homeschooled or went to private schools. Because, you know, the whole idea that thinking people have to have a tenured government official blathering in front of them in order to learn a subject is like, where did this ever come from?
Yeah, you would think that with such a high opportunity cost that, okay, property taxes pay for it and they call it free. It's not monetarily free, but just the opportunity cost alone of 5 hours a day, 5 days a week for 12 years, these kids better come out brilliant. We better have like only Elon Musks coming out of these schools with all the time. They better be brilliant. And so much of what they learn is in spite of the teacher, because they're looking up things on their phone, going to Wikipedia, Khan Academy. Sure. Even these free educational organizations have YouTube channels that people watch, not to mention the Libertarian Institute is a great free educational archive on all things history, politics, and economics and philosophy. So it's just amazing the low standards people have for the violent sector of politicians.
That's a good point about the opportunity costs, and that's One thing, it just mortified me looking at the, for instance, No Child Left Behind, because you had all these kids squandering billions of hours taking tests that were calibrated to produce BS results, to show adequate progress based on an ever lower standard. And, you know, and just the degradation. I mean, back when I was a teenager, there was a point where my love of reading came back after being schooled out of me. And, you know, as soon as you have that love of reading good books, and having to sit and listen to a tired government official telling you something, and you're sitting there, and every third sentence, you know, you want to say, no shit, can we move along? But you can't. You got to wait 12 years.
You do, unfortunately. I remember AJP Taylor was giving an interview, and he said, most schooling, referring to history, is 90% true and 100% useless. And I thought,
well, that's
good. So perfectly said, because I'm like, all right, okay, he sailed the ocean blue in 1492. That doesn't tell me anything about the importance of trade among nations, or yeah, whether it was beneficial, you know, on net or anything. There is one of my favorite quotes from Henry Hazlitt is, the art of economics consists in looking not merely at the immediate, but at the longer effects of any act or policy. It consists in tracing the consequences of that policy, not merely for one group, but for all groups. So what I want to do is go through a number of things that you mentioned in your book. Tell me the potential downsides or costs of these things, because they're sold to us as just inherently beneficial. First off, the Patriot Act. What are the costs or downsides of the Patriot Act?
Well, a major cost is unleashing the Justice Department and the FBI to ravage Americans' privacy and their constitutional rights. And to see how easily the government covered up its abuses for many years, and to see how little opposition there was on Capitol Hill, you had a handful of folks like Senator Russ Feingold, who were very good. He was the only senator to vote against the Patriot Act. But for the most part, it just showed that the founding fathers assumed that people would have a spine. But the Patriot Act illustrated how easy it was for a president to make congressional spines disappear.
Civil Rights Act. What are the downsides?
Well, the Civil Rights Act, there's 2 points on this. One is the 1964 Act did prohibit prohibit all states, and that was especially impacting the South, from having racial double standards to having basically a caste system prohibiting people from being treated equally based on their race or ethnic background. Flip side is the act itself did not authorize it, but bureaucrats and later politicians basically contorted it to justify racial quotas and hiring quotas, and also to endlessly browbeat companies to lower their hiring standards in order to close the gaps in the hiring. And so you had so many disruptions for the American workforce, and that's continuing.
It's just amazing how comfortable these people feel with putting massive obligations on other people as well as employers. Like when I see 89% of, you know, elementary teachers are female, it never occurs to me to start, you know, a Male Lives Matter movement. Or when I see 95% of people killed by police are men, it never occurs to me to say it needs to be 50-50. Half of the people killed have to be women, or it's unjust. It's amazing. That just never occurs to me. I can't believe they've gotten that scam out. Another thing you mentioned, I just want to cite this from the Cato Institute. The share of U.S. jobs requiring an occupational license increased from 5% in the 1950s to 22% in 2021. What are the costs or downsides of occupational licensing?
Well, occupational licensing devastates freedom of contract. It makes it a lot more difficult to be mobile, to move from one state to the other if you're in a licensed profession. Back, 40, 50 years ago, there weren't that many occupations licensed. Now there's over 1,000. And it's so often there's a lot of corruption in the licensing. There have been some really entertaining scandals for massage licensing. You can imagine the kind of bribes that get paid on that. But it's interesting. I've spent some time in Germany looking at the occupational job training system there. And one thing that struck me was that there were only two occupations in Germany that are not licensed: journalists and prostitutes.
Yeah.
And I guess they find a difference.
You know, people think that the massage thing is small. I went to doctors for, I think, 25 years because I was born with a brachial plexus injury. Tons of pain. I assumed I was going to have to live with it. It was actually a massage therapist that got me out of that constant excruciating pain.
Great.
So, I mean, people think that this is just like some technicality that, oh, I just want to do this and really defy Joe Biden when I go get a massage, you know, just to relax after a long day. This actually determines whether or not people can get their foot in the door in an industry that they love. It means customers have fewer choices when there's more licensing. You have higher costs than you otherwise would have. And these pricks to think that they're so high and mighty by putting all these obligations on total strangers under the guise, of course, of always keeping us safe. When it comes to the TSA, Transportation Security Agency. Now, what could be wrong? Transportation isn't wrong. Security isn't wrong. And agency, there's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong with the TSA?
TSA has been a great source of comic relief for me for decades, ever since it was started. They've had so many scandals. They were, in 2004, I wrote for the New York Times about their nationwide looting scandal. Because TSA brought all these, bought a bunch of explosive detection machines that were completely useless, gave all these false alarms. So when there was a false alarm, the TSA agents would have to search the luggage. Well, I wonder what happened. You had over 500 TSA agents fired if they were caught stealing, and the actual number is probably vastly higher than that. But that led to other scandals. You had the whole body scanners, which is basically taking a nude photograph of you, your federal dossier. The early models of that were used radiation on travelers. And that's kind of like, you know, it's kind of one thing that struck me was that what sort of safety data did they have for using radiation on travelers? And it turned out that a fair amount of the data actually was extrapolated from what happened to the people who had been in Hiroshima. And so I'm thinking, this is a great basis for airport safety. And, you know, I've had a lot of tussles with TSA over the decades. I was flying back from Portland, Oregon on Thanksgiving 2015. I made the mistake of using hand sanitizer before the flight, and I opted out, and the guy was doing the strip test here. And then he latched onto my hand and gave a positive alert. I said, a positive alert for what? It doesn't tell me. And so having glycerin, the glycerin in hand sanitizer was sufficient to trigger the explosive alert from TSA. It shows you how bad their system was. But because of it, I got marched out and had this TSA agent who basically tried to turn my family jewel into a pancake. And so it's like, you know, I need to do some investigating on this. So I hounded them, I pounded them, I got the videotape, I wrote about it for USA Today. And I've made it warm for him since then.
Have you? I have been a net taxpayer. I write in my book for about 11 years now. And I have never once been thanked by a cop, soldier, teacher, or politician for being such a taxpayer. In the private sector, I'm thanked every single day for wherever I give my money. So, at a man of your age, I won't ask how old you are, but have you ever been thanked by any of these? I know it's a softball question, but have you ever been thanked by a politician for all the taxes you paid?
Never thanked for the taxes. I have had some politicians say that they appreciate my articles. I'd rather.
No politicians thank you for all the taxes you paid. it just drives me up the wall because we're constantly saying that government is what, you know, keeps us safe from this constant war of all against all and really helps us get along. And I go, no, it's much more divisive. It creates a bunch of entitled, spoiled brats who, even though they get $6.27 trillion last year, no thank yous, no, hey, we're really working on making sure we spend this money efficiently. And sorry for all the homelessness. We're going to work on that. Sorry for all the crime. Never any apologies or thank yous.
Yeah, and there's a wonderful saying from 100 years ago, historian Henry Adams, he said, politics has always been a systematic organization of hatreds. And this is what we're seeing in this country, especially the last 10 years, 8, 9 years. And it's probably going to get worse in 2024 with the election. So there's so much acrimony and just people staying forever angry, and it's us against them. And it's like, you know, as Rodney King said, can't we all just get along?
Back to potential downsides. Central okay. Intelligence Agency. What is the downside of the CIA?
Well, it helps drag us into foreign wars when after they overthrow foreign governments and everything turns to crap in a foreign nation. And the CIA has turned its efforts against Americans as well. There was the Operation Mockingbird. There were a lot of prominent American journalists on the CIA payroll. The CIA had a big role. The CIA had some role in the Hunter Biden laptop cover-up. A lot of the former CIA officials signed this letter that says, well, this is the hallmarks of a Russian disinformation operation with complete BS and helped influence the 2020 presidential election. The CIA is part of the deep state, and the deep state is becoming every presidency a bigger threat to American democracy.
Yeah, I remember Joe Biden bragging about this. He goes, five former directors of the CIA from both parties have concluded that what he's talking about is a Russian plant on the presidential debate stage, referring to Hunter Biden's laptop. Yeah, total lie.
That was the final debate, and one of the I've forgotten at what stage in the debate he made that statement, but it was a complete fraud, and the FBI had validated that laptop. CIA should have known, but you had all these officials who wanted to get jobs in the Biden administration or else to get contracts. So they signed off on that. I think it was Anthony Blinken who organized the big letter to endorse the Russian plot, and last I checked, he was still Secretary of State.
Don't remind me. All right, the FBI. This one I'm a little more white-pilled about because you have people like Vivek Ramaswamy gaining popularity after he talks about abolishing the FBI. So we're getting a little change in public opinion. What are the downsides and costs of having the FBI?
Well, you have a nearly all-powerful federal agency that's often exempt from the law and the Constitution. I wrote about the FBI killing of Vicki Weaver at Ruby Ridge, a mother holding her baby. The FBI director, Louis Freeh, publicly attacked me on that in letters to the Wall Street Journal and Washington Times. And I managed to get hold of a confidential Justice Department report, 500-page report, that basically proved everything I'd said about the case and showed that he was the one making false statements. But you still have all these politicians who put the FBI on a pedestal. Hale Boggs, a House Majority Leader, I think in 1971, said that it was basically profound corruption of democracy because you had so many people on Capitol Hill were visibly afraid to criticize or challenge the FBI. And here we are 52, 53 years later, I think we've got the same situation. There's a handful of folks in Congress who will challenge the FBI, but basically we don't know what they have done. We don't know what their role was in January 6th and the Capitol clash. And there's all kinds in the FBI and other federal agencies. It's amazing how much Americans don't yet know about that when you've got judges or secretaries of state claiming that justifies them nullifying voters' choice in 2024.
Yeah, and the Gretchen Whitmer kidnapping plot. Oh. I remember hearing that and saying, oh, they caught it before it happened. I'm going to have to look into that one.
Just lucky, yeah. Yeah, I wrote about the initial court verdicts on that. The feds went back and, you know, what can I say here that would not be too inflammatory? Let's just say that the feds worked very hard to get a different verdict than some of the other accused plotters. And they managed to get some convictions, some not. But that whole case was a travesty. You had, you know, it's just before the 2020 election. And you have this stuff, again, made whole cloth by the feds and ludicrous case. I mean, but, you know, we've seen a lot of those since 9/11, some often targeting Muslims or minorities. It's a mess.
Yeah. And wasn't Randy Weaver set up by an FBI informant selling him like a sawed off shotgun by just a quarter inch?
Yeah, he was set up by an ATF informant.
ATF informant. That's right. Two more.
Set up by ATF, and then the U.S. Marshals killed his 14-year-old son by shooting him in the back. So, and then the FBI arrived.
Two more on on this section. National Security Agency, downside of the NSA.
The death of the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment protects, Fourth Amendment recognizes Americans' right to privacy, and to be exempt from warrantless, unreasonable searches. NSA vacuums up everything. In the last few years, the FBI has been caught doing illicit searches of over 3 million Americans. We don't know how many more there might have been, but that's thanks to the NSA vacuum cleaner.
If I remember Oliver Stone's research, he's usually good on an issue like this. I think James Clapper just lied under oath with regard to the PRISM documents that Edward Snowden released. Isn't that the case? You have the director lying under oath about what the NSA is actually keeping us safe and what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to understand how the laws work. Perjury is a crime unless you're a federal official.
Final example, the Drug Enforcement Agency. Now, I don't want to live in a society full of a bunch of drug addicts shooting up heroin all over the place. What's wrong with the DEA?
Well, you know, there's another agency that doesn't like me. I'm just, you know, I failed to, back when I was young, my father gave me a copy of Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. And I have utterly failed on that score here in D.C., I was denounced by the head of the DEA, I guess it was about 30 years ago, because I went down to Guatemala, talked to a bunch of business folks and others down there about how the DEA was wrecking farming, how they were poisoning crops and disrupting things. I came back and wrote about that. The DEA chief says, you know, basically, I was a damn liar. And then the following years, of course, there was one DEA scandal after another in that part of the world. But DEA is another agency that's exempt from the law, and so it can pick and choose who it wants to prosecute. I mean, federal drug laws. I mean, the ATF. If you want to buy a firearm, you have to fill out this form to say you're not a current user of illicit narcotics, including marijuana. And so you've got 25 million gun owners. Who also use marijuana, which is legal in most states now, but it's prohibited by the feds. So the feds have a pretext to drop a hammer on gun owners and, vast numbers of gun owners if they want to do that.
Did you ever read the CIA's A Study in Assassination? I think it was written in 1953, the year before they went to Guatemala and practiced assassinations there.
No, I haven't read that.
Yeah, this is just amazing because you got them dead to rights, and a significant portion of it is actually dedicated to how to cover up assassination, but it's referred to as just a study. Of course, they're never going to use it, except when they explicitly used it with Patrice Lumumba in the Congo in 1961, based on Eisenhower's orders. So it's just incredible. Time and time again, we have extremely high standards for the private sector, and the complete opposite for the state sector. I want to finish up by asking, what were some of the books you read at an earlier age that convinced you that libertarianism was the correct way to approach the world?
Hayek's Road to Serfdom had a big impact. And it's funny, that was something I learned about because William F. Buckley came to my college campus, or I was attending college before I dropped out, Virginia Tech, and he was touting that book that I had not heard about before. Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom had some impact. Hayek was a lot bigger impact. I was interested in, I was following, I was coming of age in the 1970s, and I was watching the I watched the Nixon administration collapse because of its lies and cover-ups. I saw the war in Vietnam collapse after all the lies and cover-ups. I saw the U.S. currency collapsing from inflation, and the government was just seemed so utterly untrustworthy at so many levels. And I was thinking, hey, there's got to be a better way.
Excellent stuff. The title of the book is Last Rights, The Death of American Liberty. Find it on Amazon. I will link to it in the description below. Thanks to everyone for watching Keith Knight Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Mr. Bovard, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me on.